In the construction business and can't find what you need, Quality Supply and Tool has served Hoosiers for over a quarter of a century. Tom Hawk is the branch manager of the Indy location on South Harding Street.
We've always been big on keeping our shelves fully stocked of inventory of industrial-grade tools, concrete, masonry products, as well as the necessary accessories to help get the job done. You don't have it, you can't sell it. Our experience allows us to help with getting the pros as well as the weekend pro taken care of.
Quality Supply and Tool also has locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to help you think outside the box. Store.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it. He has won his fourth Indianapolis 500.
Beyond the Bricks with jQuery and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5. The Fan.
jQuery, Mike Thompson, Landon Coons is our producer. Quality Supply and Tool putting it all together for us. Beyond the Bricks, another episode. We thank you for listening, whether it be here on the radio station in Indianapolis, WFNI 93.5 and 107.5, The Fan, from the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center, or perhaps you're listening in podcast form. If you are unfamiliar with the program, it is about the history, the people, the stories, the lookbacks of the Indianapolis 500-mile race. And I was thinking before we got ready to do this installment of Beyond the Bricks that essentially, if you have seen the movie Back to the Future, I would be Marty McFly. That means that I am not necessarily wearing a ski vest right now, but I just kind of float along and ride along with Doc Brown, which would be Mike Thompson, who you hear, because he facilitates for our travels back in time. We are not driving a Dallara. We're not driving the DW12, rather a DeLorean at 88 miles an hour. And Landon Coons, I guess, in this equation would become, and I hate to call him a canine, but he is Einstein. So that's who he would be in riding along in this hour journey each and every night, taking a look back at the Indianapolis 500. Mike, a pleasure to do it once again, as always. And in this scenario, we're going to go back, and I can't believe this, but if you think about the movie Back to the Future, in the movie Back to the Future, they go back, what, 32 years, I think, prior in the DeLorean? And we're going to go back 40 tonight, which is hard to believe, but take a look back at the 1985 Indianapolis 500-mile race.
Yeah, I can't believe it's been that long either. And if I'm Doc Brown, do I say "Great Scott" several times during the show?
You do.
What I'm supposed to do? Okay. Yeah, I can't believe it's been that long either. It just amazes me.
Actually, you know what? You could say "Great Scott" because one of the drivers we're going to talk about that was a storyline in the 1985 Indianapolis 500 is none other than the first that we will hear from, who is a Scot. And I don't mean from Scotland either, but we will get to that. Let's begin with this, Mike. Danny Sullivan, the 1985 Indianapolis 500-mile race winner. And when you look back at the 69th running of the Indy 500, the interesting thing is, for a guy that I think, if you look back, Mike, and follow me here, but if we were to go back and look at any number of races over the course of years, and you just throw a year at somebody, I think 1985 is as connected to that driver and immediately making you remember a moment for a driver in the Indianapolis 500 as any driver of any year. There are some years people have to stop and think, oh yeah, that's right, so-and-so won. You mentioned 1985, everybody immediately remembers not just the winner, but a moment tied to that winner. And the irony in that, Mike, is when things first got underway in the month of May 40 years ago, Danny Sullivan was not necessarily one that was making the constant headlines and immediately on people's minds.
No, he was not like one of the forefront drivers. I mean, he had just conned to Penske after leaving Doug Shearson's outfit, but he wasn't one of the people immediately considered, a threat to win the race at that point. I mean, Mario had been fast in practice. Bobby Rahal had been fast in practice. And as we'll hear in a few minutes, the Buicks ended up showing up on pole day. But Danny really wasn't the first person that came to mind.
So let's go back and talk about the pole day and the fact that you had The Buicks, and you know, one of the things I think that was fascinating about the Buicks back then, Mike, for those that maybe aren't as familiar with that era and hear have heard us talk about it in the past, Buicks, bottom line, tons of horsepower, super fast, great qualifying cars. Getting them to run for 500 miles was the trick, and that was still something they were trying to navigate through in 1985.
Absolutely. And I mean, they only did 500 miles twice, and that was later on. I mean, Al Sr. did it, and Ari Leyendijk did it in 95 because he passed Jack Villeneuve at the end of the race. If you remember, right at the finish line, he passed Jack to get back on the lead lap so he could do 500 miles. And that's the only two times it happened. So reliability obviously was the bugaboo, the thing that stopped the Buicks from being, you know, a threat to win.
Lots of eyes on the Buick in 1985 as they get set for pole. And, of course, everybody knew there was a lot of horsepower within those engines. Mario Andretti, Bobby Rahal had been the fastest cars throughout practice. Pole day arrives 11 o'clock in the morning. The first to go out on pole day was none other than Great Scott, as you'd mentioned, Scott Brayton.
Down the lane, straight away, taking the green flag, and Scott Brayton on his way to be the first qualifier for this year's 500. Some month, Donald Davidson's here. This would be Scott Brayton's fourth start. This is very similar to the operation that he had last year. It's a team that's owned by his father, who's a former driver here, but he never made the race. Lee Brayton was here several times. This engine effort, though, seems more serious than in the past. B6 Buick, as last year, but they ran fast last year, but he had some problems.
So what we heard there, obviously, is that the Buick getting out there, Scott Brayton going first, they did have speed. We'll find out more about that in just a second, Mike.
Yeah, and what's interesting about that clip is actually a guy on Reddit, believe it or not, posted that. His dad recorded that live, and he was generous enough to put that up there for us. He put it up on YouTube, and it was kind of cool because he put the entire first hour of WIBC coverage with Donald and Lou Palmer, which I thought was interesting. I mean, I know the quality is not the greatest on that, but it is an interesting little tidbit and an interesting piece of history. So that's why I wanted to play it tonight. But, you know, Scott Brayton broke the track record, so it was kind of cool to hear Tom Carnegie there. And then right after that, only a few minutes later, Pancho Carter breaks the track record, and he ends up starting from the pole.
And, of course, Pancho Carter in that particular race would start on pole. By the way, I love the fact, Mike, if Scott Brayton was in the Hardys car, do you think that that means that several people got their Hardys racing wristwatch to be able to go out and watch?
That's right. They're a Burger Chef. You ended up with your digital sports watch from Hardys or Burger Chef.
I guess Hardys, Burger Chef became Hardys, right? So Pancho Carter started on the pole that year, but not the day that he was looking for when the race itself got underway, completed just six laps and finished last. Had to be frustrating. Speaking of frustrating, it was that way for A.J. Foyt when it came to his qualifying efforts. One of the great things about A.J. Foyt, amongst many, the personality and just the honesty and at times the frustration that would ring through. A.J. Foyt was much slower than he expected to be when it came for qualifying in 1985. And when he was interviewed on the public address and WIBC, he made sure everybody knew about it.
WIBC Indianapolis as we go back to the track.
A.J. Foyt has qualified and didn't care for the way the car ran. The crowd reaction had to do with the expressive phrase that he used to describe it. We'll simply say 205.78
screwed up this morning. We just didn't get it straight now, but the biggest thing is trying to get in a damn race and win it.
Well, hopefully before race day you can.
Thank you.
A.J. Foyt, not happy with the qualifying speed, thinks it stays in the field. We're getting ready to go racing race day. Al Unser getting ready to qualify now in car number 11. We'll be back with his run in just a moment.
That's how it sounded 40 years ago, but of course with the buildup for qualifying and the field being set, then it comes time for race day, and that's what we will take a look back when we return. Taking a look back in depth is the way it sounded for the 69th running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race. Took place 40 years ago this month. You're listening to Beyond the Bricks.
In the construction business and can't find what you need, Quality Supply and Tool has served Hoosiers for over a quarter of a century. Tom Hawk is the branch manager of the Indy location on South Harding Street.
We've always been big on keeping our shelves fully stocked of inventory of industrial-grade tools, concrete, masonry products, as well as the necessary accessories to help get the job done. You don't have it, you can't sell it. Our experience allows us to help with getting the pros as well as the weekend pro taken care of.
Quality Supply and Tool also has locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to help you think outside the box. Store.
The future of Harlem rests in your hands.
The MGM Plus original series, Godfather of Harlem, returns. Starring Academy Award winner Forrest Whitaker.
There's a new kid in town.
And Rome Flynn as Frank Lucas.
I'm the boss of me.
Critics rave about the rare gangster epic.
My father's planning a war.
Praising it as a great prestige drama.
Nobody plays Frank Lucas.
We will go to war.
Godfather of Harlem. Watch now, only on MGM Plus.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
One of the most beautiful race cars that has ever raced the 2.5 mile oval at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway was that that Danny Sullivan piloted in 1985. 40 years ago, the 69th running of the Indianapolis 500. Taking a look back at that race, Jake Query along with Mike Thompson, Quality Supply and Tool is the sponsor. Landon Coons is our producer today as we take a look back from the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. Mike, we had mentioned this earlier, and that is the fact that Danny Sullivan was one that, even though obviously he was driving for a great team, even though he is one who was really right in the zenith in terms of his racing career and open wheel racing in North America and, you know, the times in which he was competitive and running towards the front, he is not one that stole a lot of headlines through practice and even really throughout qualifying setting up for that race that year.
No, I mean, he was steady and he, you know, was getting used to a new team. I mean, he told me in an interview, we're going to use some excerpts of that interview, but he told me they were confident. They felt like they were quick out of the box. They just, you know, they weren't a threat for the pole, but he felt like they were quick out of the box. He ended up qualifying eighth, which doesn't sound bad, but at that point, honestly, was bad. And that's because at that point, between 1911 and 1984, nobody had ever won from eighth. They called it the eight ball spot. You didn't want to be eighth. And so Danny Sullivan qualified eighth. And so that was kind of a, a spot that nobody really wanted to be eighth at that point.
And so the front row, we talked about it, Poncho Carter, Scott Brayton, and another guy who I have a feeling we will be talking about on Beyond the Bricks over the course of the month, and Bobby Rahal up front. Danny Sullivan starting in that elusive eighth position, as Mike had talked about. But at the start of the race, it was picture perfect indeed for one of those starting up front, the 1985 Indy 500.
And the pace car going by me right now while the field is still coming through the short chute. Now the pace car ducks to the inside. The pace begins to quicken here in turn number four. The field looks to be in pretty good formation. They're off turn number four, headed hopefully for a green. Here's the voice of the 500, Paul Page.
Rahal, they are on the main stretch now. The starter, Dwayne Sweeney, looks over the field. They come neatly to the start. A smooth, fast start. The green flag is out. Poncho Carter accelerates. Brayton jumps back. And now the field heads for the first turn.
And it's going to be Bobby Rahal out in front. Then Scotty Brayton. Then Poncho Carter. Then Mario Andretti is fourth. They're in turn two.
Mike, I am going to make a pact for myself this year. We have in the past mentioned, going back to a famous clip from Howdy Bell and Johnny Rutherford, the homemade strawberry ice cream. I don't think I've worked that into a broadcast yet. But this year, at some point, I'm going to say that the field in turn three is coming in neatly.
That would be cool if he did that. I like when you do some callbacks to previous years. So you definitely should work that in.
I will try to work in the fact that it happened neatly. Now, if in this year's installment of the Indianapolis 500... something happens with one of the cars that is starting up front, we certainly obviously never want to see that, but if there is a mechanical issue or things go awry, then perhaps I can again do a callback to 1985, because that's exactly what happened with those oh-so-fast Buicks at the start of the race.
Let's go to the second turn. A report that Poncho Carter was smoking Howdy.
Yes, he is smoking as he just goes by us and heads up the backstretch. It appears to be oil smoke, but we wouldn't venture a positive guess on that. Larry Henry, can you see him now?
Poncho Carter's down to the inside. Smoke coming off badly. That number six Valvoline Buick Hawk, he's down to the yellow line. He may be headed for the pits. There is a lot of smoke. He went down to the inside to let traffic go high. He's in four.
Poncho Carter is below the white line, and he is headed for the pitch. The pole sitter is in early trouble here at the 500.
And the yellow flag flies again in Indianapolis, this time because Scotty Brayton has come to a stop up at the north end of the speedway. We go back to Larry Henry.
Well, Scott Brayton currently sitting in his race car. It's down below the yellow line in turn three. The fire crews were immediately there just in case there were onboard problems in that car. Brayton is yet to unbuckle and climb out of the race car. He's still sitting in there. I don't know whether he thinks there may be a problem underneath the car that was causing the smoke that if he got back to the pit area they could fix or what, but as much smoke as was coming from the car, you would have to assume that it was engine related. But so far Scotty is yet to climb out of that racing machine. He's okay, but it looks like the number 37 Hardy's Buick is done for this day.
Of course, that was the bad news for the Buicks. The good news for the race fans, Mike, is that in that 1985 Indianapolis 500, pretty good battles that took place up towards the front, and it was Mario Andretti who would be a main player throughout the course of the day. And I mentioned Bobby Rahal. He was very involved with Mario as well.
Yeah, Bobby Rahal was really strong at the beginning until later on he had a problem with the waist gate on the car and ended up dropping out fairly early. I mean, before the first half of the race was over. So that took Bobby out of contention. But, Mario obviously was extremely strong all day, and it looked like it was a good opportunity for him to get that second win.
So with those two, Mario Andretti and Bobby Rahal, going back and forth, eventually Danny Sullivan decided that, you know what, he wanted to get involved as well. So as we head towards the midway point in the race, suddenly then, Mike, Danny Sullivan becomes a player.
That's right. He got a message from his crew on the radio, and he misunderstood the message a little bit. He thought that the race was almost over. I mean, that I've heard a couple reports, one that he heard a message that said, hey, there's only 12 laps to go, something to that effect. He told me in an interview that he thought that the race was winding down and that there couldn't be that many laps left, so he better get going, and it was time to make a move. So he and I talked about this in an interview we did about, why he tried to make the first move he did on Mario.
It may well have been that his stopwatch in his parking lot in California with Marty and Doc Brown, they simply looked down and he couldn't figure out the timing of it because it hadn't been explained to him that he was going 88 miles an hour in his DeLorean like we talked about in the beginning of the show. Either way, Danny Sullivan explaining his misunderstanding as to exactly where time was in that 85 race.
Well, I thought it was later in the race. I didn't think necessarily it was nearly over, but that's true because we had some issues just with wind buffeting and so forth. And when you're drafting somebody down the front straightaway, you know, you're focusing on them and making sure. And Mario was moving around quite rightly, you know, trying to protect his position going into one and so forth. So you're, you know, trying to concentrate on that. The buffeting's coming. Couldn't read the pit board. I'm not even sure I paid that much attention to the pit board, but I couldn't read the pylon. And the radio wasn't 100% clear, so I didn't hear exactly what they said when I asked them how many laps was left in the race. But I would have passed, you know, my car was good enough off of 3 and 4 that's why 1 was the spot. I wasn't as good compared to Mario off 1 and 2 to really draft him down the back straightaway into 3. And that's why I did it the first time, and the second time was in the same location. But I just kept thinking, oh, you know, it's got to be getting close to the end of the race. Mario's tough at the best of times to pass, but he's going to be really hard at the end of the race. And that was part of the motivation to go ahead and get it done. Plus, I didn't really want to sit behind him any longer. You know, I'd rather have been out front leading in the clear air than getting buffeted around behind him, hoping for him to make a mistake because, you know, Mario doesn't make any mistakes.
The irony of Danny Sullivan not necessarily having a real grasp of real time in that particular race is on lap 120, there would be a moment that would become frozen within it. The legendary moment for Danny Sullivan in the 1985 Indianapolis 500 on lap number 120.
They come onto the main stretch. It's Mario Andretti being chased by Danny Sullivan. Sullivan darts out, pulls alongside Mario Andretti. It's a drag race down the main stretch. Can Sullivan pull Andretti into the first turn? Ron Carroll.
I got him, and it is Danny Sullivan gets him. Danny Sullivan gets him down. No, he's squirreling. No, he's spinning. Danny Sullivan spins, but he goes around twice and gathers it in.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti, gathered the car back up and continues on.
You know, I can never say for 100%, but just, you know, remember the apron was down there, then the lines, the painted lines, and then the track. So there's a slight change when you come back off of the flat apron up onto the track. It's not, you know, it's not like the apron's progressive and then, you know, all the way up. And then, you know, remember those lines are down there. They paint those things every night. So they've got a little bit of buildup on it, and we were running a stagger back in those days on the bias ply. And so that was an issue. And just, you know, when they went across there, and we don't run very much wing on those things at all, so you don't have a lot of downforce. And just the combination of everything just tripped the back, you know. I don't know and I don't remember how many miles or laps were on the tires or anything like that, whether they were worn down a little bit more than a new fresh set. But I just think all of that just got the car going, you know, just moved it slightly. And at first, I thought I could catch it. I thought I'd be able to just put a little opposite lock in. But the thing is, it bit, and it was about to turn, you know, nose first on the front end. And that's why I just turned the wheels back. You know, and when I say turn them, it's not like it's a big movement. You know, you're talking about just cranking your hands on these things, you know, a quarter of an inch or something, just trying to, you know, not big, any big drastic movements. But once I turned back, it did a couple wiggles, and then I was gone. And I think what saved me and helped and kept it off of the wall was that I started the spin so low, and I was quite far around the corner. So there was more of the corner had been completed, if you like. So I wouldn't say I was straight, but I was at a little bit straighter of an angle, you know, and you know, than I would have been if I'd started to spin a little further back down. And plus, I was so low in the, you know, started so low down, you know, that gave me extra cushion, if you like, away from the wall. You know, it's easy to sit here and analyze all this stuff now, and having talked about it over 30 years and back and forth, and you know, been questioned on it and so forth. You know, I'm not so sure if you'd asked me, you know, 2 minutes after the end of the race, I would have given you that much detail.
Exactly.
You know, but that's, you know, nature of history.
Here's the thing about that moment with Danny Sullivan in the spin, and I can only imagine that he now has been, as he has told me before, that he's gone to banquets, gone to different events, and they want to talk about Formula One or talk about his career after racing that he's been involved in business purposes and aeronautics and other such things. Everyone wants to talk about the spin to win. And the most common question, naturally, one would assume would be, what in the world was going through your mind, and what were you thinking as you were spinning there in the south end of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway? Mike Thompson, who you hear on this show, of course. Mike, you asked him that question. Danny Sullivan's answer was pretty simple. I don't know. It happened pretty fast. Let's hear from
Danny. No, I mean, yes and no. You know, it's obviously happening fairly quickly, but I was more angry at myself that, oh, you just got in the lead of the Indy 500, and now you're going to go hit the wall, and, you know, and you know, so I've got my foot on the brake, and I'm just anticipating going there, and of course, then it, you know, smoke cleared, and I go, there's a turn two sweets, you know, because you're not, I wasn't 100%, you know you're spinning, but it's not like I'm following every millisecond of the spin and know exactly where I am in that stage of the spin. But when I did that, I thought, take your foot off the brakes and, you know, maybe you can save this. And, you know, that's all going through your mind, like, you know, in that sort of speed. It's just how I described it is about the pace that it seemed like it was happening in my head and on the track. And, of course, then it was like, you know, back in the day, what everybody forgets, it was only a five-speed gearbox. So it was three speed-up gears, if you like, to get out of the pit. And then two top gears that we ran, which were about 200, 250 RPMs different. So if you were racing a guy, you'd have a low in the lower gear just for more RPM and more pull to get off the corner, or the top gear to maybe save a little bit of fuel. And but the engine's dead, so it was kind of like, okay, what gear do I jumpstart this thing in and get it going again? Because too low a gear would snap it, and too high a gear would just grab the wheels and stop it. You know, not stop it on the track, but just stop it and turn it sideways. And if you actually watch the tape right in going into three, you can actually see me the car, you know, get a big wiggle on as well. And I thought I was going to lose it again. I thought I was going to lose control of the cars. These cars, especially when they had the staggered wheel, you know, tire size and so forth, they didn't like to get too sideways. And it almost lost it again. And to this day, I don't remember what gear I put it in. I still don't remember. But anyway, it kind of got it going, and I was radioed Derek, hey, it's me. The yellow's for me. The yellow's for me. All's okay, but I need four new tires. So, you know, that was it. And, so I had all those thoughts going, but I was more angry at myself for getting into the lead of the 500 right there and then spinning. You know, I would have ended up leading the 500 for, you know, 300 yards, if you like, so, which wouldn't have been very impressive, certainly not to Roger.
The gear that he put the car into, simply put, Mike, was the go gear, which is what he needed at that point, in particular because what we're about to hear on the other side is the fact that The spin to win was incredible, but his work was not yet done for the day, Mike.
That's right. There was still more work to be done, and he still had more laps to do it in, which was fortunate. It wasn't near the end of the race yet.
Epic battles with Mario Andretti that would continue for Danny Sullivan, which we will hear when we continue on Beyond the Bricks.
In the construction business and can't find what you need, Quality Supply and Tool has served Hoosiers for over a quarter of a century. Tom Hawk is the branch manager of the Indy location on South Harding Street.
We've always been big on keeping our shelves fully stocked of inventory of industrial-grade tools, concrete, masonry products, as well as the necessary accessories to help get the job done. You don't have it, you can't sell it. Our experience allows us to help with getting the pros as well as the weekend pro taken care of.
Quality Supply and Tool also has locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to help you think outside the box. Store.
The future of Harlem rests in your hands.
The MGM Plus original series, Godfather of Harlem, returns. Starring Academy Award winner Forrest Whitaker.
There's a new kid in town.
And Rome Flynn as Frank Lucas.
I'm the boss of me.
Critics rave about the rare gangster epic.
My father's planning a war.
Praising it as a great prestige drama.
Nobody plays Frank Lucas.
We will go to war.
Godfather of Harlem. Watch now, only on MGM Plus.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
That is indeed the topic tonight, 1985, the 85 Indianapolis 500. And Mike, let's begin before we hear more about what took place in the second half of that race of our personal recollections. That's the great thing about the Indy 500 is everybody can immediately remember where they were, whether it was inside the oval, whether it was at a barbecue, whether it reminds you of maybe a family member that unfortunately is no longer with us. That's the beauty of the Indy 500. Your recollections of your personal experience of that 85 race?
I was at with my family doing our usual barbecue deal that we always did. We didn't unfortunately have bowling for soup like we just had on the, you know, playing 1985, the great song we just bumped back with there. But no, we were doing in Toledo, we were doing our little barbecue we used to always do, which was great. We would listen to the race on the radio and then have a little barbecue afterwards and then watch the race on ABC at night. So it was a whole day of fun family activities.
That was the year that my dad was in the steel business and he would get tickets each and every year. Typically, Mike, when you lived in Indianapolis, you didn't know really whether or not you were going to be going to the race because you were hoping on a wing and a prayer that tickets would somehow surface leading up to the week of the race. That happened for me in 1985. And my dad, as a steel representative, told me going into it. Now, Jake, just so you know, technically speaking, you are supposed to be a customer of mine. So if anybody asks, you know, you could say that you are the son of a customer. And I said, okay, sounds good. My dad said, but don't worry about it. There's, you know, a quarter of a million people there. The odds of us seeing anybody that would even know what's going on are slim to none. And we sat down and I watched the 1985 Indianapolis 500 in the Southeast Vista with Danny Sullivan spinning right towards us, seemingly in my eye as a, at the time, soon to be 13-year-old kid. And lo and behold, sitting directly in front of my dad and I as my small knees were hitting him in the back was my dad's boss, who I think was well aware of what was going on. But the magic of the Indianapolis 500, I think he understood also and probably thought to himself, these are memories that this kid will take forever. That's the beauty of the Indy 500, and he is correct because we still talk about to this day what took place in that 1985 Indy 500 that we're taking a look back at today. We mentioned that Mario Andretti and Danny Sullivan were battling in between turns one and two. That would lead to the spin for Danny Sullivan. He would have to go in, as you heard, get fresh tires and get himself back into the fight. And once he would do so, eventually he would find himself along with that machine of Mario Andretti back within view. That Beatrice Foods car that looked almost as beautiful to the eye as the red and white car of the Miller American of Danny Sullivan. They would do battle again, and Sullivan would pass Mario.
Danny Danny Sullivan hesitates behind Mario Andretti. Now tucks in right behind him. Pulls out alongside on the main stretch. Begins to roll past Andretti. Ron.
All right. Danny Sullivan gets him this time. Sullivan gets him this time and goes by very smoothly. Mario Andretti now dropping about five car lengths behind.
I didn't really think about, where I was going to do it. The his car, my car, the way they were working, and you're really only going to pass, especially somebody like that, unless they make a big mistake. It's going to be pretty hard to pass them in the short shoot. Okay, so you're only really going to pass going into one or going into three, and my car was better through three and four than Mario. If you're comparing the two, and we were about equal through one and two, so it was harder to get a little bit of a run off of him, off of one and two down into three, and so it really kind of dictated the terms of where I was going to do it. It wasn't kind of like, I spun down there, so I'm going to put the pass on him again in one. I wasn't thinking about that. I would have just as happily have passed Mario in a pit stop if I could have, because as I said, he's a tough guy to pass at the best of times. But now I also knew that it's much later in the race, so he's even going to be tougher to get to pass. And as I said, the biggest change I did was, when you go in there, it looks like two fighter planes kind of going down in formation together. But, Mario turned off of one and just, he came down, which was one of the reasons that I moved down so far onto the apron. And so the next time I was a little bit more, firm and held him a little longer and held him kind of up top before I turned in. And I kind of dictated when I was going to turn in and didn't go down quite so low. It was a lot more cautious on, my throttle and line and everything, so that I didn't repeat what I did the last time, because I was pretty certain I wasn't going to get away with that twice. But anyway, that's why, on hindsight, everybody can go, oh, you did this and you went back and, like you said, we're making a statement or whatever. Nah, I was just, this was the spot that the opportunity presented itself.
Mike, the reality is this. I think a lot of people, when they look back at that race, they assume, and I understand it, but I think a lot of them assume, kind of as Danny Sullivan did, that spin came later in the race and that was kind of the highlight heading down the home stretch. A lot don't realize that there was still a lot of racing left. But the reality is we kind of heard the foregone conclusion, if you will, of the race itself in those moments. Because after that, I'm not going to say it was easy for Danny Sullivan. I don't drive 200 miles an hour around that oval. But relatively speaking, it was for the rest of the race.
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, he started pulling away. Mario actually had a little bit of problem with his car. He ended up getting one more chance later on because there was one more yellow flag. And so he had one more opportunity. But, the car started going away on Mario a little bit. And so while it wasn't easy, it was definitely Danny was pulling away and had a much better chance of winning the race at that point.
And so Danny Sullivan would go on to win that race, of course. This is how it sounded on ABC television.
The old American hero will lose the race. The new American hero is Daniel John Sullivan III of Louisville, Kentucky, who has won the Indianapolis 500. Mario Andretti second. Roger Penske, the crew chief. Now is the time to celebrate. They didn't budge a muscle until he had crossed the start-finish line, that yard of brick, for the last time.
Sullivan would lead 67 laps en route to the win, but it was Mario who had led 107 laps in that race. Mario Andretti, so many times, obviously, there are those races that it felt like had just gotten away from Mario, whether it be something that happened with the car, whether it be 1981 that had been 4 years prior. And certainly as Danny Sullivan was elated to win that race, he recalls his friend Mario Andretti was not necessarily in the best of moods, understandably, after that runner-up finish.
He didn't take that particularly well. He did, you know, Mario won Indy, of course, the one time, and you know, there was a guy that should have won it multiple times, you know, and just never did. And he had a good car. He had a great car that day, and you know, he was obviously quick, and it looked like it was his race. And then when I spun, it should have been his race. And you know, came back and passed him. So he wasn't really. I don't think he was so much upset with me per se, as just frustrated that he didn't win it when he had such a good chance. You know, for a second win. So he was pretty quiet about that. But I don't. We're very friendly. We see each other. We have great talks. He was great help when I did the Red Bull Driver Search program, and great supporter of that. Because his background with, you know, sports cars, Formula One, Ferrari, everything, you know, so he was a great ally at that time. But you know, I don't rub it in either. You know, I wouldn't want it being rubbed in on me, so I'm not going to do it to him. He's just too good of a friend.
You know, Mike, it's interesting. If you were to look back, and I don't know that there would be any way to tabulate this, I will pick on your brain here as a historian yourself, of certainly the broadcast historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Obviously, Donald Davidson is the historian emeritus of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. But in terms of the archive and the understanding and the location, for that matter, of so much audio and visual record of the Indianapolis 500-mile race, if you were to somehow do a survey, Mike, of the most played or watched video in the history of the 108 previous runnings of the Indy 500, that moment with Danny Sullivan in the spin would have to be top five, would it not?
Oh, I would say 100% it would be. And, you know, it just takes on such a life of its own over the years. And one of the things that I like about it is, you know, ABC would do those, you know, those open vignettes every year, and they would have different actors come in and do them later on. After they stopped doing the Delta Force thing, they started having actors do it. And there's an actor named William Fichtner who did it one year, and he's kind of walking around the track, and he's basically pointing to where that spot happens. And he's like, and Danny Sullivan opens up a candy store on Mario Andretti at that spot. You know what I mean? And it's just, it's one of the great lines of one of those opens, and it just brings you back to that moment. And that whole year brings back a lot of memories for me, because the reason I picked that clip, the ABC clip, no disrespect to the IMS radio folks, but just the way McKay, you know, that's Jim McKay's last call as play by play. You know, he's off the broadcast as play by play after that. And the way he, it's kind of a passing the torch moment, you know, because it's, you know, the old American hero is going away, and Mario, he's not going to win today. And the new American hero is Daniel John Sullivan III. And I've always known Danny Sullivan's middle name because of that. You know what I mean? It's just because of the way he's Daniel John Sullivan III, and he's from Louisville, Kentucky. And I've always known that because of McKay's call. And so to me, that's one of the more iconic calls that doesn't get a lot of discussion, is McKay's call in 1985, and it's the last call for McKay, because he's no longer play-by-play after that.
Hard to believe that it has been 40 years. Hard to believe that Danny Sullivan is not still the dashingly good-looking, he's a nice-looking guy, don't get me wrong, but, you know, he was such a, at the age of, I believe, 35 at the time, now Danny Sullivan in his mid-70s. Been 40 years since, and when I talked about the fact that that is such a seen clip, that includes the number of times that Danny Sullivan has rewatched.
And I've got to admit that every time I watch it, I get goosebumps. I know the result, and I just, but it just kind of gives me, boy, were you one lucky dude, you know, on that day. How you pulled that off, I have no idea. And just listening to everybody, you know, Jim and Sam particularly, and Paul Page, and, you know, of course, to go on to work with Paul, ball and see his enthusiasm in the booth and actually feel it when you're sitting next to him actually working. It's a special moment. People still talk about the spin and win, and now it's a great honor. It's just a very cool thing.
And he's talking about Jim McKay, Sam Posey, obviously Paul Page as well, and Danny Sullivan. As much as he knows what it meant to hear those guys call it, he knows what it means to you fans as well.
I can't tell you how many covers of the Sports Illustrated I still get from people now, that how they find that, and I've still got names on it and so forth, and they've sent it on to be signed. That's pretty cool. And just wanting to make the cover of Sports Illustrated was pretty cool. But for everybody to remember it and still get everything, hey, spin to win and so forth. It's a neat experience.
Mike, Danny Sullivan is one of those that is a true gentleman when it comes to the Indy 500, and that day the race chose the right winner because he is somebody who has always carried with him the appreciation of not just the event but the fans being able to appreciate it as well. A lot of fun, Mike, taking a look back at 1985. Let's do another one, shall we?
Sounds good to me. I'm in.
All right, this has been Beyond the Bricks.
The future of Harlem rests in your hands.
The MGM Plus original series, Godfather of Harlem, returns. Starring Academy Award winner Forrest Whitaker.
There's a new kid in town.
And Rome Flynn as Frank Lucas.
I'm the boss of me.
Critics rave about the rare gangster epic.
My father's planning a war.
Praising it as a great prestige drama.
Nobody plays Frank Lucas.
We will go to war.
Godfather of Harlem. Watch now only on MGM Plus.
El sarampión es una enfermedad seria y altamente contagiosa. De acuerdo a los CDC, uno de cada cinco enfermos de sarampión en los Estados Unidos serán hospitalizados y corren el riesgo de desarrollar discapacidades de por vida. Este año se ha detectado un caso de sarampión en una escuela preparatoria al sur de la Florida. Para mejor protección, tus hijos necesitan dos dosis de la vacuna MMR administrable desde los 12 meses a 6 años de edad. Vacunación gratuita está disponible mediante el Departamento de Salud del Condado de Orange. Protege a tus hijos contra el sarampión. Visita protectyourchildnow.net.